closer.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Hey everybody, welcome to Two Magicians, One Mic, the Quarantine Sessions, number two.
I'm Simon Carnell.
My name is Nick Paul, and we have a very special guest, friend of ours, from Magic Bar LA, star of Broadway, television, and a Disney Imagineer, Mr. Benjamin Schrader. Everybody, a big round of applause for Ben Schrader.
Oh, it's thunderous. Please, come on. Just a podcast, please.
This is coming in post. Don't worry about it. It's still going.
Wow, it really is a lot. I mean, we're really taking a lot of time with this applause.
We have so much time that half the podcast is just going to be canned applause and laughter.
That's good.
Everyone really does have a lot of time on their hands right now, don't they?
It's kind of crazy. That may be the only time in the foreseeable future that we hear actual group applause.
So this session is particularly interesting for me because I know you two have done a bunch of stuff together, but I don't know Ben at all, really. Like, I know of you. I've seen Magic Bar one time. That was great. I saw you in that Pella thing at the Magic Castle that I think Steinmeier wrote or directed.
Right.
Like a cynical advertising guy in, which you were kick-ass in that. But we've never actually really talked, ever.
No, not really. We've kind of seen each other in passing at the castle every once in a while, which is never a really great time to connect because you're usually on your way to the next line. But
So you're an Imagineer. I didn't even know that.
I am. Yeah, I'm. With great power comes great responsibility. I mean, as far as some things I can talk about, and I would, and some things I can't.
That's fine.
But then again, I mean, the whole industry right now is kind of up in the air. I mean, it's really interesting with all the parks closed. You know, I'm working on Avengers Campus right now, which is the new Avengers Park at Disney California Adventure. And we're in the middle of construction, you know. So these are interesting times when you're putting a theme park together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just got offered, I haven't done Disneyland in a couple of months, and literally three days before Disneyland shut down, we got a wonderful announcement that said, hey, congrats, you're going to 7 days a week performing. I'm like, wow, they haven't done that in 3 years. This is amazing. And then 3 days later, just kidding, everything's closing down.
God, so close yet so far. So you, Ben, how long have you been an Imagineer? What's your background? What in 100 words or less, life story in 100 words?
Yeah, for
me as well as the listeners, because I don't fucking know.
Well, when I do Magic Bar, I make sure to let the audience know. No, Ben is like this amazingly, absurdly talented actor and magician and Disney Imagineer. And when you're at Magic Bar, you're just kind of this guy hiding, you know, making amazing cocktails. And just to see everybody's eyes change when you go, no, he was in the original cast of Book of Mormon. And they go, oh.
I mean, Magic Bar's is like a little sanctuary for me. And for me, it's all about the experience. My background, to kind of sum it up, is I was a theater guy for a long time. I still am a theater guy. And I did Broadway shows for a long time. That was my goal. That's what I loved doing. And I moved to New York at a young age and pounded the pavement and then got into a whole bunch of shows, Avenue Q and Ragtime, the revival of that show, and Big River and Book of Mormon, the original company of that. And so that was my life and background. I had a job that I was going to go to back in 2014 after a national tour of this one show I was doing ended, and it fell through. It lost its funding from these big time producers. It was going to be my next Broadway show. I mean, you get on that path and you just start doing show after show after show once you kind of get in the club, as obnoxious as that sounds. And then, so I said, oh, let's just go to LA. We had taken a trip out here while I was still living in New York working, and went to the castle actually. And I fell in love with the castle in my first visit there. And I mean, it was like unlike anything I'd ever been to. Matter of fact, I didn't know anyone who was affiliated with the castle. I didn't know how to get an invite. But because I was in Book of Mormon, the first year of that show, I got to meet everyone you ever wanted to meet.
Yeah.
One of those people was Judd Apatow. And for some reason, we just kind of kept in contact. And Judd Apatow had a friend who was a member and then got me in because Judd Apatow picks up the phone and I guess.
Yeah. and Judd Apatow gets results.
That's right. So got me into the castle for the first time. Later on, when I moved here about a year later, my wife was doing a show with Robert Ramirez. They were doing a musical together.
And was that In the Heights?
No, it was Beauty and the Beast. It was a regional production of Beauty and the Beast. And Robert Ramirez was playing LeFou, you know, the sidekick. And my wife was playing Belle. Anyways, we were at a cast party at the opening night. And my wife goes, oh, you have to meet our LeFou, Robert Ramirez. And I said, oh, yeah, I mean, we were just brand new to L.A. at the time. And she goes, he's a magician. And I said, oh my God, this is great. I used to have a Blackstone Junior magic kit when I was a little kid. I loved magic when I was a kid. And then for some reason it just went away. I just didn't do it anymore. So, you know, like anyone who hears that someone can do a magic trick, you know, you go, can you do a magic trick? And he looks around and I'm actually surprised looking back that he didn't have a deck of cards or a full set in his pocket at the time. He didn't.
This is because Robert is a gentleman of standards.
That's right. He wasn't ready to perform, but he did do the coolest thing. He grabbed a cocktail straw off of the bar and he held it between his fingers and he went pop and it was gone. And it's like that scene in Ratatouille where the food critic takes the bite of the food and then all of a sudden, you know, and he's like 5 years old again. It was just like that. I went, what? Everything paused. And I looked at him and I went, you're my new best friend. Teach me everything. And then he kind of got me. I started going to the castle a lot with him. And I said, I have to work on this. I have to be a part of this community. It's different. I feel like it's different than anything that anyone I know is doing. And I just fell in love with it's like the most macro micro theater. You can do an entire incredible show with nothing, almost for no one. And it is still highly impactful. So I just hit the books and met Jim, and Jim knows some of my acting background. He had this play. And so it all just kind of started to be related. Meanwhile, I was also designing cocktail menus for some of the big speakeasy bars in LA for Clifton's, the Pacific Seas Room. I designed their whole program and trained their people because I like experiential speakeasies and bar stuff. I had some background in that. And so it all started coming together, and the magic world is really what brought it all full force and together. And from that, Disney started showing up. I had been affiliated with them for a few different theater projects years ago, but when they started coming to Magic Bar, they went, well, this is interesting. What is this dynamic about? And I basically said exactly that. I said, this is, you know, low cost, high impact entertainment that never went away. It's always been there. You just, you know, Disney Imagineers, they forgot about it in a way.
Yeah.
You know, they want to solve every problem a lot of the times with these incredible pieces of technology or advancements in AR and VR and stuff like that. But you go on the Haunted Mansion and they're still using the classic, you know, tenets of magical illusion. So it all started to kind of coalesce with my work with Steinmeier, and Disney started coming and knocking. And so theater, magic, all this stuff seemed to be a valuable resource for Imagineering. And I started going from project to project. And so now this big project is with this opening of the park. And my job is to basically, you know, bring some magical elements to some of their live stuff that they're doing in the park with some of their characters. So it's left field, man. There's no bigger example of stuff coming out of left field than my trajectory over the past 4 years.
Yeah, that's amazing. That is a great story. I love it.
Yeah, what's so great about?
I kind of feel like, you know, I was just going to say, you kind of go the direction the horse is going. You know, it starts to go this way. You're like, well, let's just go this, see what happens. Let's see where this goes.
Yeah. What I love so much about Magic Bar, I mean, this is me looking at it from a business perspective, is that it's, you know, max 20 people. It's a small space, so you have a small overhead, and yet you're still getting top notch performers to do this very intimate show. And I think that's what a lot of magic theaters are kind of missing that are opening up, and that will unfortunately, I think, really struggle with what we're going through right now, is that there's just too much overhead. And you can't, if you want to make a profit, you can't do that in a theater setting. You know, you have to keep it, you know, small and contained.
Well, you know, to be perfectly, you know, to be perfectly honest about kind of how Magic Bar even exists is because it's under the umbrella of there's a restaurant company called Scratch Bar and Kitchen, and they have this very successful tasting, high-end tasting menu restaurant, which is really experiential and very cool. They also have a sushi bar restaurant, which is this omakase, very high-end secret sushi bar. The man who owns on and runs it, he's a guy from Top Chef, Philip Franklin Lee. He fell in love with magic. I took him to the castle and wined and dined him and said, here you have a sushi bar that is empty on Monday and Tuesday nights, meaning it's not even open on Monday and Tuesday. They're open 5 nights a week. So you have just this real estate sitting here, and it's the perfect place for close-up magic. Look, it's better to make some money than no money. Why don't we go in? We'll bring Robert Ramirez in there at the beginning, you know, and he kind of came up with some, you know, initial concepts with me, which was amazing. And we went into this together, putting together a close-up magic show every week, originally just on a Monday night. And, you know, at first it was three people that were friends. And then we got a couple of reviews, and there's something about, you know, giving the theatrical impression that something is exclusive.
Yeah, it's a very LA thing too.
It's very LA thing. At the time, our tickets were $12, I think. And that I even thought, I was like, that's a little much, $12. But at the time, you sweet
theater child.
I know, right? Yeah. I was just so desperate for audience validation. That was currency enough. But then people start showing up, and then celebrities start showing up. But you know, the thing is, it's been protected by a restaurant, you know, and I think it's a business model that I fell into, and it actually is fortunate, and it benefited the magic, because all I had to worry about was being a creative director. I had a space, I could decorate it, you know, for the night. And then, you know, at first kind of have magicians do a little bit of favors. I throw them a few bucks based on tickets, you know, sales and stuff. And then when I got it at a price point and negotiated with the restaurant, you know, it's a little jewel in their portfolio that they can say, hey, come back and visit us again if someone has dined at their restaurant. Come back, visit us again. And also, we have this little amenity here that we can, you know, offer to you. So you've basically, you know, I've created value beyond just the show itself. You create a commodity. So the show itself becomes this commodity that exists for high-end people that have already dined at the restaurant and stuff. So they view it as this special bonus. But then I put tickets on Gold Star, and I make tickets affordable to the public, and people feel like, well, here it is in the valley. I don't have to go over the hill for an evening out. You know, it's a mom and dad who have maybe one night every 2 weeks, and that's the night that they use for their date night. They go eat in a restaurant, and they come to Magic Bar. So it just happened to be situated in kind of a sweet spot for putting on a close-up magic show. And, you know, with other venues like, you know, Magicopolis, now Illusions, things like that, they're filling a theater. That's a tall order. That is a much more difficult job, you know, that John Armstrong is trying to do there, and those guys. So, you know, I'm fortunate that I've kind of been, I get to be just the creative director, and I don't have to worry about real estate, liquor license, all of that stuff. So, I mean, I'm totally transparent about the fact that, you know, it just happens to be a really good business model. One, though, that I think can be applied to other businesses. It's like those nesting dolls, you know, it's like a business within a business within a business.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I never thought of it that way, where it's like you are in a very good position of not having to worry about liquor and like being able to be part of this other kind of bigger thing. It's a very good spot to be in.
I love how that's kind of pro tip number one
pro tips
for the session is, if you're starting a show, keep your overheads low.
Yeah.
That's pro
absolutely.
Tip number one.
I mean,
it's also funny how what you're describing, the fact that, like you said, you're able to get really good talented magicians at this thing, really speaks to something that I've been more and more aware of as time has gone on, as an explicit trade-off, that when you, as a magician, assuming you're good and there is some kind of demand, you will need to do a gig for either good money or good times.
Right.
And it's so rare that you can get both. And as you all know, a magic bar does not pay a high amount, but it's a really fun venue. It's a great place. It's a privilege and a joy to get to work a good venue that's actually optimized for magic. So we'll
you know,
do
I try to, yeah, I try to make it, you know, I try to make it, you know, one of those things where, listen, it's important for me that I pay people. And I'm, you know, it's important for me that I try to find that balance of, if I'm going to charge a certain ticket price, that has to reflect the payment that I pay the magicians. Mm-hmm. So this has to be, you have to find this kind of metric that makes sense, because you don't want to undervalue the ticket to a show, any show, whether it's a magic show or a theatrical piece. You don't want to undervalue it. You certainly don't want to overvalue it. And there's a lot of shows that are overvalued. And you and to factor what that number is, you know, of course you just do that over time and see what the market demand is, but you try to factor in, if it wasn't for the magicians, this wouldn't exist. You know, and if I'm gonna have rotating magicians every week to get return customers, which I have been, you know, you have to value it at a place that's sustainable, but that's respectful. So, you know, you have to do a little due diligence to find that number, and you have to see what people are, you know, what people aren't going to be offended by. I don't want to go to Nick or John Carney or Steve Valentine, Robert Ramirez, anyone that I hire. I don't want to go to any of these people asking for a favor. You know, I want to say, like, here's the thing. Here's the money. I happen to be in a convenient location, if it's convenient to you. Hopefully it's convenient to most magicians here in the Valley. And I will make sure that you have guests. I'll take care of that. You add as many kind of amenities on top of it, because I know what that's like. You know, we're all kind of gigging here. And
yeah, well, we were.
Formerly.
We were.
Now we're just talking to ourselves on Zoom.
That's right.
Well, you have a great intro that I love. Is, you know, you open with a piece when, you know, after you serve some drinks, the music kicks in, and then you intro the magician and you say, you know, if I'm going to cram you in this tiny sushi bar, you better see some really fucking good magic. Right. And it really sets the precedent for what the show is going to be. Because I think a lot of people who haven't been there before stumble in and go, you know, what the hell is this? What's going on here? I remember I had that the first time I walked in and go, this is interesting.
Well, you were hesitant, you know, I saw you in the parlor, and I loved what you did. Now, everything that you did is not what you do at Magic Bar.
No, I think I do maybe one thing from that show.
That's right. But I loved what you did. And it was just, it was a theatricality that I really liked. And you know, I kind of was like, here's this place. Come and at least see a show. If you like it, you know, maybe we can talk. And you came, but then it was a little while before I heard from you, not too long. But, you know, it was one of those things where I get it. I want people to be like, just come see something and see if you even like the space. Really what it comes down to, though, is I'm asking a lot of magicians. I'm saying, hold court for 50 minutes, not just do magic for 50 minutes, which is difficult by itself. I mean, that's a lot of material, really, but hold court. I mean, I'm there to facilitate. I'm there to kind of keep the ball in the air, but you know, the magician really has to kind of go in and take this group of 18 or so people and lead them through something. Doesn't have to be profound. It just has to be enough that these people feel like they're being taken care of by someone who really knows what they're doing. It's like when you're watching any, you know, big star in a musical and they walk out on stage and you breathe a sigh of relief, hopefully, because you're like, Nathan Lane knows what he's doing. We're in for a good time, because no matter what happens, the lights could go out and we're in the care of this consummate professional.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is, you know, something that I discovered after, you know, a while booking Magic Bar, is that what I'm asking guys to do and girls to do is quite a lot, you know.
Yeah, and I remember one of the few brief conversations we had was about how a lot of people just can't do that. It's a really tricky thing.
Well, it's interesting. There's really great magicians who have an amazing 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. and nothing that's against that, because a lot of times that's all they're asked to do.
Yeah, and that's what they want. That's what a show needs.
Right. And they take that 15 minutes and they evolve that, and they switch things in and out, but they have a solid 15. But an hour, you know, close to an hour, that's a different story. So sometimes you have people that have, I have two 15 minute sets, and I want to have a little moment in between where I'll, you know, Ben will jump in and do a little something. So I'll go in and do, you know, the longest, you know, out of this world you've ever seen, but it's entertaining.
It's the most entertaining, but it is the longest.
I get 35 minutes out of that, out of this world.
That's right. I mean, listen, I make no bones about it. I'm primarily I'm a magic producer, you know, and I love magic and I know a lot of magic and I design it. You know, same with like someone like Jim, I by no means compare myself to his depth of expertise, but you know, Jim understands, knows, and designs and writes about magic and has produced a lot of magic in the past. That's kind of my trajectory. So my job is just to make the magician that I have in my space, at least at Magic Bar, that's the show. I want to make that show theirs. When Nick comes in, I want to, you know, I want people to feel like, you know, for the next hour, Nick is the star of this thing. And this guy's cool. He gets us going, gets us a nice drink, and gets us happy. But Nick is the star of this thing. And that's my kind of goal there.
That was I think that's why I was so hesitant, was because I see myself as a stage performer, and I looked at that venue as a close-up venue, but really it's a stage show. So once I change my perspective of it, I go, oh, I do this all the time. And I think that's what a lot of guys who are reaching out to you don't realize, is it's not a close-up show. It's a stage show, but in a very intimate space. So you have to kind of treat it that way.
Yeah, it's a stage show, totally.
Well, it's one of those things where I've sort of had a perpetual rant for a long time about how our taxonomy of the genres of magic has always been fundamentally broken, that this like close-up versus parlor versus stage is not actually the breakdown, because it's much more nuanced than that. And a lot of quote-unquote stage shows where, e.g., if you're using a projector and doing quote-unquote close-up, it's not close-up because it's on a stage, but then if it's close-up, but is it's just, it's always looking at the environment going, what is required of this situation, rather than trying to fit it into a category. Because if you do the latter, you're always going to miss something, as opposed to looking at the situation and adapting to whatever that is, which will be
I think you really back yourself into a corner when you start to compartmentalize.
Yeah, completely.
This is my opinion, but as far as I'm concerned, it's all theater. Magic is not an extension of theater. Magic is its own theater, but it runs by the same tenets of theater. And whether you're performing for 1,000 people or you're performing for 6, or 2, it's still the same tenets of your trajectory of performance, your storytelling abilities, all of that. It's all the same. All you have to do is kind of either reduce or augment how people can consume it, you know, making it big enough for people to see, all the logistics of it. So, you know, with Magic Bar, you know, we want to say, oh, is it bar magic? Well, no, it's not really bar magic, because it's called Magic Bar, but it's like a set. You know.
And what does that even mean? There's a lot of different definitions you could apply to quote unquote bar magic, that all of which are right sometimes and wrong other times.
Yeah.
Right. There is magic at a bar, or there's like what they did at Shulian's back in Chicago years ago, where you have a raconteur behind the bar saying, take this card, you know, shuffle this deck right here. What do you want to drink? You want this, this, this? Yeah. I said shuffle the deck. All right, grab these two coins. Here, this. I mean, the guys who can do that.
Yeah.
That's its own thing, you know.
Yeah, I've always, this comes up a lot that for me personally, particularly at being sometimes asked to judge magic competitions. And it always annoys me when they're just, this is the stage competition, this is the close-up competition. And those are not, again, those are not useful labels. What's useful is describe the constraints. Okay, in this, you'll be seated at a table, there'll be 20 people watching you, and what you call that is irrelevant. Just describe the thing. Labels are usually dangerous traps and to be avoided, I think, a lot of the time.
Yeah, when I do my ace routine on ships, you know, it's a close-up trick, but really it's not. It's a theatrical trick, and my very simple ace routine that I don't think fools any magician, but really gets a nice reaction because there's a story and there's an element to it that everybody in the theater can relate to. It's now a theatrical piece. It's no longer just a card trick, and I think the difference of separation.
Question for Ben, because I mean, first of all, it ain't close up unless the audience is close to it.
Exactly.
And they ain't.
Yeah.
So it ain't close up.
Sure.
But bam, done. But so Ben, I'm slightly paraphrasing this. One of my favorite definitions I ever heard, because I lean towards inclusivism with definitions of anything, because I think otherwise you trap yourself, like you said, you constrain yourself needlessly. But theater is basically any time anyone does anything with the intent of engaging those watching. Just anything. Like almost all interactions like that are theater.
Yeah.
And then you get to more formal theater, informal theater, outdoor theater, simple theater. Do you have a definition you lean to? Do you not think about it? Do you have any response to that? I'm interested. You know, way more than I do about it.
Yeah. Well, I think what it comes down to, it comes down to the parameters. So what are your parameters of performance space? So traditionally, the parameter of performance space is a proscenium arch. We're used to watching theater, or at least we think of theater, and we imagine the proscenium arch. We imagine we're an audience and we're separated from the performer. And the grand separator, the denominator that defines that, is the proscenium. We watched it through a window.
Well, now, actually, what do you mean by proscenium?
The columns on the side of the stage, and I mean the top of the stage, literally the picture frame that physically surrounds the stage. And they can be ornate, or they can be, you know, they can be a black box theater, but there's usually some sort of space between the audience, we're facing you, and you're the performer, framed by the proscenium, facing me. It dictates where my eyes see, it dictates what I'm supposed to be paying attention to. It frames you in a way that subconsciously and consciously defines you as the performer. So now you start playing with that proscenium, and we've seen magic delivered in that proscenium arch. The great magicians in the golden age of magic, of course, used to play Broadway theaters. Houdini performed on the proscenium, but then he would also go outside and perform hanging upside down, or a magician perform something in the round or whatever. So you start to play with the borders of the proscenium. It's still theater, and I'm still on a stage, and you're still an audience. We're still having, there's this differential in relationship. And then you can start to really play with that. And then you can get into things that people would define more as performance art. Now let's take magic and put it on the street. Now let's do street theater. All right, so physically the proscenium is gone. And yet, why is it that when a magician is performing, automatically a semicircle starts forming around them? That's an important thing to kind of start to regard. The semicircle starts forming because we're programmed that there's a performer, there's a space between, and there's an audience. All right, so we create our own proscenium. Well, that's interesting. Where did we learn to do that? We learned to do that around the campfire, right? We learned to do that with storytelling. So then you start to take it even farther. I mean, what's farther than that, I think, is, you know, it is the hanging upside down over Times Square kind of straitjacket stuff. Now we start going into performance art, potentially. And yet there's still an audience space. So we redefine it all the time. I mean, we do this culturally, we do this socially. We want to define performance space. What I'm interested in is how do we create those spaces? How do we reduce those spaces? How do we start playing with that relationship between audience and performer, and then what defines that? I mean, I'm a believer that not everything is art. You know, people say everything is art. A leaf blowing down the street is art. Personally, I don't think so. It can be beautiful. It can totally be beautiful, but that's not art. You know, someone could say, well, I say that's art. Well, I guess then it's art to you. You can say that. No one has a ownership of this, but, you know, I think it's about what finding those defining things. Where it gets interesting, I think, is performance art. I have not seen a magic act necessarily be performance art. David Blaine has done some interesting things where he's done kind of some spectacle. It's close to circus, maybe. But, you know, true performance art is stuff that, like, freaks people out, man, you know. And yet you can kind of go and break it down and still define that as art. Magic, to me, is the most portable proscenium art form. You can sit down at a dinner table and do something, and you automatically create a proscenium instantly. You create an audience performer relationship instantly with two rubber bands. There's something immediate about magic. And I recently came to this thought, which was, next to music, I think magic, the art form itself, when it's imbued with the right performer and the right material, I think magic is the most powerful form of theatrical device that breaks through cynicism and breaks and gets to the emotional core. I watched David Kovac with two rubber bands made this woman in the front row magic bar, just inches before her face, cry. And she didn't know why she was crying. And he passed one rubber band through another rubber band. And it really hit me kind of hard. I was like, what is that? What's happening there? She started tearing up. She goes, I don't even know why I'm crying. And I had to think about that for a few weeks after. And what I think it is that she had a calcified definition about how rubber bands move through the world in her brain. she just took it for granted. She didn't think about it. It was, these are rubber bands. I know how they move. I know how they operate. And right in front of her, 6 inches away, David Kovac passed a rubber band through another rubber band. And all of a sudden there was a crack. And there was no other response to have than just a flood of emotion. And it happened to be with her. Tears. Could have been laughter. It could have been anything. But something fundamentally shifted. So for me, I'm like, man, next to music, I can hear a single note on a violin and weep, you know, because there's something about it that cuts right through. Mm. Next to music, though, I'd say magic. I haven't seen, even in all the theater I've seen and all that, I haven't seen anything that can get someone at an emotional level like magic can.
Particularly that quickly, you know, and that efficiently.
That quickly. I mean, that's fast, man. And with rubber bands, unless, you know, she had some emotional connection already to rubber bands.
her dying father's last word was rubber band.
Rubber band. Exactly right.
Don't forget to band up my old postcards that I sent to the woman that I never saw. She went away in World War II. Sorry, there's a whole story forming in my head.
So, I look forward to seeing this rendition at the next Magic Bar.
That's right.
Which might be God knows when. But
we don't know exactly of the
many enjoyable, fascinating things in this already great conversation. That my favorite thing you said so far that has stuck with me was connecting your magic experience to that great scene in Ratatouille, because that is just one of the best scenes in cinema. I mean, animated cinema, totally. Whatever you call it. And I had never made that connection before, because one of the things that we struggle with as grizzled professionals is it's so easy to forget that magic is actually amazing. Because it is not anymore. It is long. We have long lost that. And it's such an ironic, weird thing to say that the wielder of the power does not realize the power they wield, but it is absolutely that. And it is, I constantly have to remind myself that, like, it's not like I don't know magic's amazing. I see people gasp, but you get separated from it. There's sort of a wall of fog between you and the emotion. And it's that was a really good way that kind of reminded me of it just then, brought it back to me. Really
well, you know. You know, Jim Steinmeier, who I've been so fortunate enough to have as one of my friends and mentors, you know, we talk about it on a fundamental level. We talk about this kind of stuff. And he said something interesting. He says, there are three scripts in a magic show. There's the script you have to learn, the physical script of your banter, your all that. Yep. The second script is the trick, you know, the logistics of, you know, the order of operations of any magic trick. And the third is the script that has to be running of the audience's, your understanding of the audience's perspective, which is why in a magic trick, we do that thing where we say, now you recall, you shuffled the cards, you cut the cards, you dealt the cards out. It was completely free choice. That little kind of
distorted recap.
The distorted recap, the convenient memory.
Yeah.
You know,
it was a brand new deck of cards that you purchased yourself.
That's right. You forged these cards in your workshop. you know, but understanding, you cut down the tree. Yeah, right.
Given my past week, that's actually true.
You know, but understanding those three scripts simultaneously is difficult. And if any one of those scripts drops out, the show really suffers. If you're a magician and you're not aware of the audience's narrative and where they're at your show, then the trick means nothing. If you're not, don't know your script, then your trick is bad. And if you don't know how to do the trick, then you're just talking into the wind. So, you know, understanding kind of that audience's perspective and empathizing with it, that's, you know, good theaters, being a good actor is being empathetic, I believe. And it's the same with magicians and magic. It's having that heightened empathy to be able to understand, you know, the workings of especially that third script, the audience's understanding, listening to the audience and acknowledging where they're at in this thing. And that's how you get them, man.
Yeah, it's so hard for me to watch a show that I mean, as a friend said about somebody who will remain nameless, and this applies to, I think, a lot of magic shows, is the show would be the same whether or not there was an audience there. And I think a lot of magicians, not a lot, but, you know, a fair amount of us forget to listen to what the audience is saying to us, even if it's silence, you know, listening to how they're reacting silently to something. And that's a great point you just made.
Yeah. It is a thing that I notice now all the time about performers. And Ben, I would love to know whether this is something you notice in theater as in other forms of theater. I mean, again, theater being incredibly broad. About, I now catch whether an audience's mental energy and focus is on them or on the audience. Are they thinking about themselves and, oh, I'm the great magic person, versus what are these people experiencing right now and how can I guide that and shape that into something beautiful?
Well, I mean, I think that's the most important. It's pretty fundamental from a theater perspective, but even theater artists need to be reminded of this all the time. I mean, this is the first time the audience has seen this. You know what I mean? This is the very first time, you know, when by year three of a Broadway show, when you're going out on stage, you're doing 8 shows a week. And, you know, you have to almost out loud say that to yourself, which is, look, this is the 1,000th time that I've done this. But this is the very first time that any one of these people have seen this. And I have to engage my empathy. And I have to, even if I'm faking it, which is totally fine, you better fake it good, though. And you have a responsibility to fake it if you have to fake it. Because this is the first time for most of these people who have seen anything, whether it's theater, whether it's your theatrical piece of magic, whether it's anything. And what are you doing it for if you're not going to be on the side of the first timer, you know, you have a responsibility, I think, just to yourself, really, to your own sense of integrity, to find the freshness, or to be able to successfully fake the freshness when you need to, you know.
Creative field.
Absolutely. And if you're not doing that, man, then you better change it up right away, or get out, because there's just too many people who are willing to be, you know, kind of in that moment and share something with an audience and be real about it. You know, if it's an exercise for you, then, you know, you're going about it all wrong.
Well, this transitions into what you were helping me out with, which now just seems sad that I was even, you know, bummed out about this. But you know, a month ago, I was really struggling with, you know, traveling a lot and going away with ships and just kind of being mentally over it. And you gave me a wonderful pep talk about when you realized it was time to be done, you know, with Broadway stuff. Just knowing, you said the curtain would go up and come down and you wouldn't even remember doing the show.
Yeah, it's like when I used to say, I still say, when you drive home, you pull into your driveway or your parking garage and you don't remember the drive and you kind of go, how the hell did I get home? You know, there would be those moments where you're taking a bow, you know, year three in Book of Mormon, for instance, and you feel like you're just punching a card. You know, you'd get to the end and it's not like you half-assed it. It's not like you phoned it in. You did your show and you got laughs and you did everything, but you don't remember. You weren't present for a single moment of it. You were on autopilot. And, you know, rather than beat yourself up over it, you have to just take a step back and look and go, okay, well, am I an actor anymore? Am I a magician anymore? Am I an artist anymore? What am I doing now? And it's a valid question to ask. And you know, with in your case, Nick, you were kind of like being bummed that you felt bummed.
Yeah.
About, you know, I don't want to travel.
That's going to be on my tombstone. He was sad.
That is feeling the constant experience of feeling meta bummed.
It's totally true. And I think, you know, I think if I recall, I mean, I kind of was like, it's okay to feel bummed out about that. It's okay to be like, you know, I don't want to do this, you know? But yeah, I think we're programmed a little bit as performers to be like, well, I have this opportunity and I can't say no to it, or I definitely can't say I'm tired of it. What's wrong with me? And it's like, no, we're artists, we're human beings. We're not really meant to do the same thing over and over and over again. It's the definition of insanity, right?
And you were saying how hard it is to change.
You're allowed to kind of go,
oh, he does this thing. He's the magic guy, or he's the Broadway guy, or he's the magic bar guy. It's hard for people to.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah.
So that's something you
we're afraid to yourself. Do that. Yeah. That's, I mean, you know, we start to define ourselves based on how other people define us. You know, I mean, it sounds a little, Hobby Lobby phrase on the wall kind of thing.
No, but, you're kidding. That sounds completely pragmatic and sensible. It's a real thing. That's absolutely right.
You know, because we're afraid of failure, and we're afraid of, you know, taking risks, especially, I don't know about that. judgment. And as we get older, it starts to solidify of like, well, I guess this is what I do. And it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, why should that be? Why should you have to subscribe to that if you're not enjoying it, or if you haven't found any kind of, you know, any kind of joy in the thing? And I think it's okay to kind of go like, you know, I'm allowed to shift this. I'm allowed to change this. And I kind of be damned what anyone else perceives as, and you have to be aggressive about it. If you are going to get people to start to value the other talents that you have to put it out there. You know, you, that's the thing. You can't expect people to know it unless you start just doing it and not waiting for permission to do the thing.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, it's a wonderful point to make.
Yeah, that's a chain that binds far too many people, is this idea that they need permission to do or think or be something.
Yeah.
And it's so limiting.
And so it's sad. A bullshit kind of construct, right? I mean, this current, you know, the current example is now of people going like, I never thought I had a voice to go and live stream something, you know, people who never did this before. And now they're going, well, they're climbing up the walls, so they want to do it. But now they're realizing that they enjoy it and they actually have a voice and that there's something to say. And, you know, so sometimes it takes a little bit of a shake to get people out of their own narrative that they've kind of created for themselves of what they do, who they are, what their voice actually is.
Yeah. Yeah. I have no idea how I'm going to pay for things in the next 3 months, but at the same time, I am more creatively motivated. I was talking about this with a friend yesterday of, you know, when I was doing magic shows in my parents' basement and making terrible movies with our VHS recorder, I wasn't concerned about monetizing it. I wasn't concerned about how I'm going to pay for things with this magic trick, or, you know, how I'm going to book more shows. I was just doing it to do it. And the only silver lining of this whole thing is that I am now being put back into that state of mind. I'm still financially terrified, but, you know, at the same time, it's like, well, what can you do? I might as well try to have fun.
Yeah, I think right now it's ever changing with the news cycle and all of that. So we're all just kind of holding on. And but there are so many things that are just out of our control. And what we can control is being, you know, all the things that we're supposed to do just as human beings: be kind, take care of yourself, you know, be responsible, you know, all that kind of stuff. But with what we do with magic specifically, you can get up and start doing magic now. When we're allowed to kind of, when the world is allowed to kind of come back together, when we get past this thing, and we will at some point, magic is immediate. It's right there and can be instantly created. There's no, you know, whether you want to monetize it or just you want to get back to performing, it actually is a skill set that I think is going to, through this, knock on wood, have even more of a resurgence than it already has, because it's there, it's available, it's low overhead, and people want to have the human interaction. I mean, it's cool that we're having online magic shows and stuff, and it's good to keep that kind of stuff going on. I mean, I'm certainly, you know, doing that, you know, with Magic Bar, keeping it online, but it doesn't hold a candle to being live, to having a group of people, to having a real experience that's not having a screen between you and the thing that doesn't have that proscenium of the rim of your iPhone. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's the art form, I actually think, is going to end up thriving because of this. And I think that the powers that be that do hold the pen that signs the paychecks, I think they're going to want to start generating some stuff immediately. And the quickest way to do that is to have the talent that can bring immediate entertainment, immediate things. I think you're going to see a surge of magic at the parks, at Disneyland. I think you're going to see people wanting that real kind of human interactivity because of this, because of the distancing of this. I feel pretty positive about it, you know.
Well, for my financial sake, I hope you're right.
Listen, mine too, buddy. Mine too.
Simon, anything else you want to throw in?
Oh, the one thing I was thinking earlier when, Nick, you were talking, it was really resonant a few minutes ago about, I remember also, again, with a camcorder, just wanting to kind of make short films just for the hell of it and reconnecting with that. It reminds me of that whole cliche about the tarot, is the death card doesn't mean literal death. it means sort of the death of a way of being or a way of thinking, the stripping away and the reevaluation. That's kind of, it means exactly this right now, what we're experiencing. This is tarot death card with a capital D.
Well,
and
sometimes
from that, and then implies then a subsequent rebirth of some kind into something different. Often.
I have not met a group of people more, not just resourceful, but adaptable and problem solving than magicians. I mean, it's what the job is. It's to problem solve and adapt. You know, something starts going south in the center of it, you know, a stack deck is dropped, whatever happens. And I've watched some incredible recovery, you know. I've watched those pivots happen in an instant, you know. And those are my favorite moments when in the construct of a magic presentation, something goes terribly wrong.
You're just describing every set I've ever done at Magic Bar.
Well, it's the greatest though, because whenever I see that, I can see the audience has no idea, but I can see the wheels turning and I can see all of the doors start to close and open. This is closed. I have to open this.
Yeah.
To get through this, to get to an ending, you know, and to watch that kind of mental agility, those gymnastics, it's super impressive. And really this situation is more of a dramatic, painful version of that. But I do think,
infinitely higher stakes
with infinitely higher stakes. But I do think our brains are wired to, magicians' brains especially, are wired to pivot very quickly and problem solve. And as stressed as any of us may be, or as tired or exhausted as any of us may be, our brains can't help but start to generate these alternate detours, these routes, these things. I see that in, like I said earlier, a micro level with a magic trick, or a macro level with a life decision.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, this is why Improv Magic Smackdown is the greatest magic show.
I've heard good things.
It leans hard into what you're describing.
Yeah. This
is great. I completely agree. I think it's beautiful. I think it's one of the best things about the art form. It's so difficult, and hence you need to become so good at adapting on the fly to unimaginable circumstances. And I think that's a great thing.
Yeah, to have those three scripts going and to have to improvise those different levels of understanding all at the same time. I'm going to change a presentation because this went south here. So let me do this. The audience didn't understand this. I skipped an order of operations here. So I know that's lacking there. Let me go to here. I mean, it's like that scene in the Minority Report.
Yeah, moving all the shit around.
Moving all the shit around. You know, that's kind of how I see a magician's brain, you know, kind of all the time.
Yeah, in a split second, in a moment, in a performance.
That's right.
This has been great. Vanishing Ink just asked, you know, they were so kind to post their favorite podcasts, and they put ours out, and they asked me what my favorite interviews were, and now I wish I could tell them this one, because I think it was one of my favorites.
Likewise.
Before we say goodbye, I always like to hear, I mean, you're kind of talking about pivoting and reacting in the moment to something that's fallen apart. Is there anything in like your Broadway history where something has happened either in the audience or the stage and you've had to react to it and try to not let the audience know?
Well, I mean, sometimes the audience, well, in musical theater, sometimes the audience knows, and depending on what you're in, it can either be a real benefit or a complete disaster. You know, if you're doing kind of a raucous big comedy like the Book of Mormon and a line gets flubbed and you lean into it in a way because you already got them in the palm of your hand, you can do that for, you know, you can play with that great comedic effect, you know, because it's very forgiving. But if you're doing a piece of Shakespeare, you're doing, you know, a long soliloquy and you go up, you go into what they call the white room, where all of a sudden I have no idea what to say next. I got nothing, man. Mm. When that happens, you know, I've learned to kind of breathe through that. And you know, there have been moments where I've seen people, not me, but I have seen people go into the white room and, you know, that fourth wall breaks. There comes a point where you just can't fake it. You try to fake it at all costs and see if you can get through it or find something, ask someone, you know, whether it's call line or something. And sometimes you just break the fourth wall and you just have to acknowledge that this is live. Let's remember this is live. And I need help. You know, man. So, I'm not one of those people that's like, you know, if you know, the show, it must go on. If you forget that, it's like, you know what? This is live. Keep a positive attitude. And
I love it.
Ask, you know, call for line, man. Call for line. We all need line.
That's so good.
Oh, I love that so much. I actually have a story that didn't happen. Well, I was in the audience at this show. This is, holy crap, probably about 18 years ago in Melbourne, back at university. And myself and some friends went to see Hot Shoe Shuffle, which was like that tap dancing musical thing that was just touring Melbourne. We got tickets. Yeah. And there's this big number that's just before intermission. And the song is We Need a 15-Minute Intermission, Boys. I don't know how well any of you know the show or not. Yeah. Maybe it's a big thing. And they're doing this really building up to a culmination. There's like eight people on stage all tap dancing up a storm. And then I do one of those sort of blink, double take. Did I see? And I realized that what I thought I'd see was a shoe just kind of fly up in the air out of the middle of the tap dancing
That's
storm.
Right.
And I sort of do that with my brain, my brain saw it, but my conscious mind didn't see it. And it's like, hey, you just saw it. I'm like, did I, what? And then I look and, oh yeah, now there's just a shoe sitting on the stage. And then I look back and there's a guy with only one shoe. And then his face was the most perfect thing I've ever seen, as he on his face was clearly going, did that just happen?
Yeah, that's right.
And then over the next roughly 45 seconds towards the end of this number, I get to watch as one by one, these seven other performers one by one realize what's happened as well. And the realization slowly moves through the group that this guy is now tap dancing one-footed. And then at the end of it, they finally finish it. Yeah. And they finally stick the landing. They make it to the end, do the big ta-da. And then all of them just, there's a pause, and then they all just crack up laughing together. And it was just one of my favorite things I've ever seen in live theater.
And you remember it because that was exclusive to you that day, that night, and that performance. And whether it's, you know, something like a shoe, or, I mean, I've been in shows where, you know, in Book of Mormon, Josh Gad, who was the lead of that show, he felt sick after the first act. So he called out on the second act. So at intermission, so he does the entire first act as Elder Cunningham. He does the first act. He goes off stage. He goes, I am dying. And they said, go home. Your understudy is going to go on. So the understudy goes on. He had two covers. He had an understudy and he had an offstage cover. There's two definitions of that. Mm-hmm. So his offstage cover went on because I was his understudy, which means I had a role in the show, but if need be, I could go on in that role.
Right.
He had an offstage cover who only was there in case he needed.
Okay.
The cover has to go on. He's got 15 minutes, you know, intermission to get ready to go on. So he goes on. Act two starts. The audience has no idea, except right before the act starts, it says, for the remainder of the performance, the role of Elder Cunningham will be played by Jared Gertner. And everyone goes, the entire audience goes, what? There was no time to do anything except sit down for the lights to go out. And they're like, what the fuck? And then the second act starts. There's the entre act and then Elder Price. And then here comes a brand new Elder Cunningham out in the second act. The entire audience is stunned a little bit. They don't know what to say. And Andrew Rannells, who plays Elder Price, he ad-libs a line. All he has to say is very quick. He just goes, you look different. And the audience goes crazy. Yeah. And then we move forward with the show.
Yep.
So it was just this little bit of acknowledging of the thing. Acknowledge the thing, break the ice, release the steam from the thing, and now we're good. And he got a huge ovation at the end, and people felt, rather than feeling gypped, they felt special.
Yeah.
You know, they got to see something that is really unique that doesn't happen very often. So anytime those things happen, whether it's, you know, in your show, or on a big scale, like a big Broadway musical, whatever, those are special moments. Learn to embrace them and not reject them or hide them.
Yeah, sometimes the tiniest little recontextualization can change something from the worst thing to the best thing.
Oh, absolutely. Everything is an opportunity. This is true.
Some things are just shit, but a lot of the time.
Fire alarms going off in the middle of your show, that's just shit. There's nothing you can do about that. Yeah. You know,
I mean, although it can give you a good story and some great media coverage.
I mean, Steve Martin used to walk his whole audience outside at the very end and then just walk away. So,
exactly right. Exactly. So, I mean, you know, you can turn anything into an opportunity, I suppose.
Mm. Yeah.
That's great. Well, thanks, buddy. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I hope you and Glenn are well. And, and Magic Bar Online, you doing this every Wednesday now?
I mean, let's not make commitments for Gus.
This coming Wednesday.
Potentially doing it every Wednesday.
I do want to do it. So if you do it again next week, let me know. I will gladly do it. I wasn't able to do it last week when you asked. I appreciate you asking me. But
it's, yeah, as of right now, yeah.
It's at Magic Bar LA.
Absolutely.
8 o'clock Pacific time on Wednesday.
Love it. That's live on Instagram,
yeah, and
right?
We have a live on Instagram. I'm keeping it easy. You can drop in, drop right. out, whatever you want to do. I'm not, you know, it's Siegfried Tieber, Kayla Drescher, Harrison Lampert, and we just do a little silly show. But it's a chance to just have a little community, really, at the end of the day.
That's great, man. Awesome. Well, thanks for taking the time. It's good to chat with you.
Kick ass.
Yeah, dude.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcast. If you really like the show, you can donate a few bucks a month on our website, twomagiciansonemike.com, or become a monthly subscriber through our Patreon link. Thanks to all the people that support the show and keep it up and running. Be sure to follow us on the interwebs at @twomagiciansonemike. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.